Let's get going. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with MPM Legal. We are a specialist employment law and business immigration practice. We're based in the south of England, but we work with businesses that are all over the UK and, in fact, all over the world. They have a common interest, which is employing people in the UK, and that's where we help them. I'm delighted, as ever, to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
And I feel a bit rusty on this because we've had a bit of a mini summer break, haven't we?
Well, I've had a big summer break. I've been on holiday, so yeah, God knows if I can remember anything at all, frankly. It feels like my memory cells have been wiped.
Getting tuned in back into the world of employment law. We're tag teaming, really, because you're back from holiday. I'm away on holiday after this. So we're going to be a little bit out of sync with our two weekly webinar schedule. But nevertheless, we wanted to get one in for August, so we weren't depriving you of some employment law updates over the summer period. So today we are looking at dismissals. And actually, rather than just sort of trudging through the potentially five reasons to fairly dismiss an employee, what we wanted to look at are really our top 10 tips to consider. They're based on our collective 50 plus years, I think, between us of advising on employment law matters.
God, that's horrifying. Makes me feel like I'm
really
ancient.
Sorry to mention that, but it's it's quite a lot of experience to draw on. And we're going to cover aspects that you might not so obviously think about. Because I think the way that I see it is the dismissal is like the tip of the iceberg. That's the sort of final thing, isn't it, in terms of what the employer's in control over it. But under the surface of that, behind the scenes, there are so many other decisions going right back to the start of the employment relationship that can feed in to how you get to that point. And so we've got some tips around those processes. Just in terms of some of the housekeeping, the whole bunch of you that are joining us live today, so thanks for that. If you want to ask questions, we will do our best to answer them. Might do them as we go along, might save them for the end, depends what the questions are. Just use the Q&A function down at the bottom to ask questions. As I say, we'll do our best to answer them. If you want to use the chat function and message anybody else that's joining today, then use the separate chat function. So thank you for that. This session is being recorded. We can't open up anybody's microphones or videos or anything crazy like that. But if you want to listen to the recording, then it's on Spotify and it's going to be on the MPM Legal website as well. So dismissals then. What we want to do is help you make those decisions that avoid that employer's nightmare scenario of getting it into the employment tribunal, right?
Yeah, and I think it's going to come into really sharp focus now. One of the reasons why we wanted to do it is because, you know, we know there's changes coming down the track from the new government, the day one dismissal rights, and we thought it was worth sharing with you some of our top tips. Because to be honest, I think we are going to be looking not just at changes to how we handle dismissals, but frankly, changes to how we manage the whole employment relationship if we want to put ourselves in the best possible position to avoid employment tribunals. Now, full disclosure on that, and everybody will know this, frankly, you cannot stop people from bringing claims to an employment tribunal unless, of course, you settle through a settlement agreement or via ACAS. And, you know, I think it would be fair to say, Peter, that on our desks at the moment are some claims which just frankly shouldn't be there. They're without merit, they're without grounds. But the point is that once those claims are in, you've kind of lost control of the process. Litigation, as most of you will know, is expensive, it's time consuming. I mean, just in terms of timings of these things and how much of your life it's going to take up, I've got a case on at the moment where the dismissal was January 2022 and the final hearing has just been postponed until February 2025. So, you know, people's memories will have gone in that base or over that period of time. But over that period of time, you've got this hanging over you. And it doesn't end until either the employee withdraws the claims are settled, or you get a judgment at a final hearing. So, you know, that's kind of the backdrop of this. But I think in terms of starting off the session, most of these issues that from our 50 years of experience, horrifying, they arise out of a lack of communication. You know, people don't talk to each other, people don't communicate properly, people don't raise issues. So it's really important to look at that from the very start of the relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just touching on your employment tribunal point, I think speak to any employment lawyer, we've all got tales of woe in terms of how long the litigation process is taking, especially since the pandemic and the impact that has had on the judicial process. And yeah, I mean, like you, I've definitely got cases that have been going on for 3, 4 years in some cases. The tribunals do have rules to try and weed out claims that don't have strong prospects of success, but there's a whole series of hoops to jump through to get those claims knocked out. And in turn, that takes time. So you need to have a lot of patience with these things. Right, before we get into it, just some basics. So first of all, and I've got to say currently with this stuff, because we all know there's going to be a lot of change in employment law that's coming down the line in the next 12, 18 months.
Yeah,
But
just to add that,
yeah.
you missed your housekeeping point. This law is current as at the 15th of August, 2024.
Yeah. I've got
Just
to take
diving
advantage
in to
of the
add that.
insurance. Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. So everything we're talking about is as at 15th of August, 2024. And that's significant, right? Because it's all going to change, isn't it? So as we're talking right now, only employees can bring unfair dismissal claims. And what do you mean? Aren't we just talking about employees? Well, we've got a category of workers under English employment law. Labour are going to be looking into that. Apparently, that's going to be potentially a big significant change, but maybe 3, 4 years towards the end of the parliamentary term, if at all. But at the moment, only employees can bring unfair dismissal claims. Secondly, currently, there's a 2-year qualification period. Now, those of you that joined our session at the end of July, when we were talking about potential changes coming in, Labour have constantly reiterated there's going to be day one unfair dismissal rights. Day one. At the moment, it's 2 years. It's not 2 years for all claims, it's 2 years for most claims. Certainly, what we call ordinary unfair dismissal claims, that's your Section 98 Employment Rights Act claim. So, kind of bog standard unfair dismissal. It's a 2-year qualification period. It is going to change in the future. Whether it'll go to day one, we don't know. There are some claims, though, you've got to watch out for where there is no qualifying service. So we call those automatic unfair dismissal claims. We're not going to go into those today. I think we'll save those up for another session. But some claims don't require that 2 years continuity of employment. The ones we're talking about today do require it. Thirdly, the employee needs to be employed in Great Britain. Now, this is relevant for all of you, and there'll probably be a lot of you on the call that have this, where you've got remote workers, and those remote workers are spending time working overseas, or you might engage people who are based overseas. To bring an unfair dismissal claim in the employment tribunal, generally the employee needs to be employed in Great Britain, but there is another limb to that, which is, or the employment relationship must have a stronger connection with Great Britain than with the foreign country where the employee works. So you see in the case of peripatetic workers, people who are moving around, maybe based in other jurisdictions, don't automatically assume that because they're not here, they can't bring an unfair dismissal claim in the employment tribunal. And I know, Adrian, you know, we've got experience, direct experience of defending claims in the tribunal system that have been brought by people who have been based in African countries. I've had one, somebody who was based in the Philippines. So it does happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always worth checking. I mean, if they're not based in the UK, don't just automatically write it off. You've got to check the jurisdiction of where they are based as well, because that's always problematic. But
Yeah.
I think we're probably heading off on a bit of a tangent
Well, I think
there.
we I'm
Yeah.
thinking we've got another session to do on that, haven't we? Because
Yeah, I think
it's a
so.
whole topic in itself, and
Yeah. Yeah.
it is quite interesting. What's our first tip then?
First tip. Okay, so this might seem an odd place to start for dismissals, but starting at the very beginning of the employment relationship, please look at your recruitment processes. You know, it'll become even more important that you've got the right people in place from the start in the future when employment rights will be available from day one, obviously excluding probationary periods, which we'll come on to. So, accurate job descriptions. Okay, don't just pull one off the internet. Don't go, well, it's blindingly obvious. Obvious is a sales exec role. Everybody knows what that is. Not necessarily true. Make sure they actually work and they're fit for purpose for your business. So that means not just accepting where they are. Talk to the hiring manager. What is it that you actually need in the role? What are your expectations? Because that is your foundation. That's your platform that starts everything off. Second point on under the recruitment. Don't hire in haste. And I know that's so easy to say because you've probably got people shouting, going, we need people, we need people. But there is the rule, isn't it? Don't hire in haste, but dismiss fast, you know, and in the sense of, you know, making a decision when something doesn't work out. Candidates, check their experience and qualifications. We've had loads of things come up recently where, you know, references haven't been taken up or qualifications haven't been properly checked out. And it turns out the candidates have been, shall we say, economic with the truth. Check the LinkedIn profiles. Do as much as you can in terms of your background checks. Meet them in person. And also, if the, you know, if they're working as part of a team, Being able to fit in with your values and behaviors and fit with your culture is really important. So get them to meet the team because they've got to be compatible. And this comes back round to this thing about communication. You know, communication between the team is something that can make or break a successful hire. So that's my top tip to start with, right at the start of the relationship.
Can I throw in something about cultural fit and fitting in with a team? There is a big kind of red flag around that, isn't there?
Discrimination.
Discrimination.
Yeah.
Ideally, you know, if and these are things that I think businesses aspire to, and we realize that in practice it's quite difficult, especially if you're a growing organization and you're not necessarily at that level of sophistication where you've got the resources big corporates can draw on. But what I'm driving at is you can be clear in terms of the type of candidate you're looking for with almost like published criteria, just so you can justify things in an objective way and then point out why somebody isn't suitable if you are really challenged on it. I mean, again, we've all dealt with plenty of claims here from individuals who haven't been successful in securing a role and have actually brought some form of discrimination claim. So that is a watch out there.
Yeah, so example, you know, when I'm talking about values and behaviours, making it clear that it's a collaborative way of working, you will be expected to share information and work with the team. It's that type of thing that, you know, and that's very sort of non-discriminatory in its nature. So it's thinking about those types of things that is setting the culture for the team where you want that person to operate. But yeah, Peter's absolutely right. We always want to avoid talking about words like fit, because that, you know, they're, you know, not a good fit for the team. Well, what does that actually mean? That is a big red flag for discrimination. So if it's they don't work in a collaborative manner and they're very sort of closed in terms of their information sharing, that's non-discriminatory, and that's kind of some differences there you can think about.
Yeah, and I think Elaine's commented actually to say, I think you're right regarding hiring, but so many managers do not want to spend time in thinking things through, not being clear in their thoughts and not providing the right recruiting brief. And, you know,
100%,
that's a good observation.
100%. Yeah, I mean, number of times recently we've gone, you know, people have held their hands up and gone, we should have never have recruited them in the first place. Let's not try and avoid making that mistake. And the thing to say to your recruiting manager at the time is, look, please spend the time doing this now, because otherwise what will happen in our experience is that we're going to come back to you and ask you to spend even more of your time managing this person, having these communications, having the one-to-ones, and then potentially exposing yourself to being, you know, on the receiving end of a grievance or being a witness in an employment tribunal. So you can either put in the pain now and the time at the very start and let's work together on it, or just be aware of the consequences that flow from it.
I think just one final comment for me on this recruitment side. I just saw a comment on LinkedIn this morning that made me chuckle, which said every bad hire starts with a good interview. And I think it was a company trying to sell interview services. So there are tools out there to help you in terms of structuring your recruitment process. Moving on, our second tip then is all about probationary periods and using probationary periods properly. Now, obviously, the probationary period should be the time for proper training on your systems, for relevant handovers from other team members, and assessment of capability and support. Now, we've done a whole session on the significance of probationary periods. In fact, that was on the 24th of July. You can find that session on Spotify. It's episode 18. It's also on the MPM Legal website if you want to see a video recording of the session. If I can boil all of that down to one sentence, it would be: put in place a structured process, follow it, and have evidence to support the decision you've taken and why. Because again, and sorry to sound like a stuck record, probation periods is going to be one area of super, super focus if Labour do come down with day one employment rights, because all of a sudden you're going to be able to need to justify why somebody shouldn't be able to bring an unfair dismissal claim for failing their probation period and being able to justify that decision. So probation periods are going to be super, super critical. I know some of our clients have moved away from using formal probationary periods. I think that inevitably is going to change. Do use this as an opportunity to get your housekeeping in order with probation periods before the law changes. And, you know, you can start by going back and listening to that episode from the end of July if you've not done so already. Next tip, Adrienne, I know you're going to talk about management skills, I think.
Yeah, I feel like a bit of a broken record on this, though. And for those of you that are regular listeners, it's something that Peter and I do bang on about quite a lot. But it's you cannot expect your managers that are good at their core abilities, their core skills to be able to manage staff without helping them. You know, just because somebody's a great engineer or a great accountant or a great salesperson doesn't mean that the next step in natural promotion should be, hey, you're fantastic at sales and you've knocked the figures out the park. Here's a team of six, off you go. It is a very specific skill set that should be treated in the same way as their substantive roles. So take the time to make sure that they're trained. Make sure that they have time to manage rather than just deliver. Because a lot of people will say, I am too busy delivering my substantive role to manage my team. You know, that's a massive argument. I mean, I can give an example on this from my own experience. So way back when in the annals of time when I was working for one of my previous employers, oh my God, it's more years ago than I can remember. When somebody became a manager, their targets were actually reduced to give them the headspace to be able to manage their teams. And I thought that was a really good positive message because it was recognition that the manager's worth was not just their own contribution, but it was saying to them, look, you're going to be measured on how successful your team is. So in that case, you're giving them the time. Once you've given them the time, give them the skills to encourage them to have the right conversations as early as possible. We're talking about probationary periods. If people have come into their team when they're already being employed for a while, make sure that they know what one-to-ones or regular meetings should look like. And it's the I was going to try and use the phrase, the conversation should be like a beep sandwich, but clearly I can't say the word on a recorded call. So it's not just how's your workload, how's your numbers, it's praise and the carrot for all the things they're doing well, but don't be afraid to have to address the things that they're not doing quite so well. And the earlier that these conversations happen, the less confrontational they are, and that then sets out this nice platform for what comes next. And the management processes have got to weed out any issues that are caught early. Then they can you can identify the training needs, you can assign a mentor, you can deal with all this stuff early on, which is the point about communication that we talked about. Sorry, Peter, I cut
No,
you
I
off
was just going to
again.
say, I mean, you know, overlaps with what you're saying about training as well and upskilling managers. I know it's something that you and I have talked about on these sessions in the past as well, but there's a big piece around educating managers or people who are responsible for other individuals within your organization, and particularly around having difficult conversations. Because I know when we're dealing with unfair dismissal claims around you know, performance type issues, and there's been performance improvement processes, or it involves somebody that's having to give some feedback to somebody else, there's a real skills gap there sometimes. And it is a skill, I think, having to give feedback to somebody, especially when that feedback isn't necessarily positive feedback, and there's a way of doing it. And you know, you and I have seen so many issues, and I'm sure you know people joining us today will have experienced it in terms of organizations that they're supporting. There's a real skill to that, and there are things that you can do to really upskill your managers to help with those conversations, because it all then feeds into just minimizing that legal risk at the end of the process, you know, if that is resulting in a parting of the ways.
And how many times do we see come across our desk when, you know, we might have a client come to us and say, we want to have a protected conversation, which if you remember, it's the off the record chat, which is we could put you through this performance process, or we could have a conversation about settlement. And the employee goes, oh, it was, you know, get a crappy letter from their lawyer going, it was a complete shock. It came out of the blue because no performance issues have ever been raised. And, you know, that's a conversation that comes up. And very often it hasn't been raised because the managers are nervous about having those conversations, or they don't feel they've got the skills and they don't want to, you know, and they don't want to do it. So it's, you know, you've got to take the employee on the journey, and the manager's role in that is absolutely critical. So following on from that, tip four.
Yeah, tip four. Before I do, somebody just asked in the Q&A about, is there a link for the Employment Law 101 sessions on Spotify? How do I find them? So I put it in the chat, and then somebody else asked if I could show details again. So I don't know if it just popped up and flashed away, but I've put the link in there. But basically, if you go to Spotify, Amazon Music, you just have to search for Employment Law 101, and it should pop up with Employment Law 101 from MPM Legal. So that's how you can find us on the music streaming services. Tip four, well, linked to what you're saying is appraisals. And I think, like one-to-ones, these appraisals need to be honest. They shouldn't be a surprise. And, you know, I always make this point when we're talking about performance improvement processes, it's the same point. By the time you get to that stage of saying to somebody, we now need to put you into a formal performance improvement plan, whatever that process looks like, the individual should not be saying, oh gosh, I had no idea
Yeah, where's this
you
come from?
talking about. Now, of course, we encounter those employees that do express that view, but you want it to be because they're a little bit deluded about how they're performing, not because they haven't heard the message before, informally and through regular management, you're not quite hitting what we need you to hit. So there shouldn't be a surprise. They could be a summary of the one-to-ones that have been held before, and there should be a follow-up from appraisals in terms of development needs. Now, again, I do have clients. We know there's organizations that don't necessarily have an annual appraisal process. There's probably like some ongoing debate around the value of an annual appraisal. I think if you are going to use appraisals, and I recognize that not every organization will want an annual appraisal, if you are going to use them, it does need to be all or nothing. And by that, I mean, I think you either need to fully embrace them and fully utilize them, and importantly, have everybody utilizing them, or don't bother with them. And you know, there's one good reason for that. Inconsistency of approach across a business opens the door to allegations of less favorable treatment. So, you know, one of the big challenges we see when it comes to tribunal litigation and unfair dismissal claims is appraisals not being consistent with other feedback. So again, it's a surprise point. So you'll get one-to-one meetings saying someone is doing a good job or just not identifying areas of concern. And then an annual appraisal that says this person's failing or, you know, they're not meeting targets, at least to grievances, maybe least constructive dismissal claims, all sorts. Appraisals not being used at all. And then the employee saying, well, how could I be expected to know that I was actually failing? And it's a valid question, right? How can you expect an employee to understand that they're not doing the thing you're wanting them to do if there isn't that structure to give them that feedback? And that's a challenge in terms of unfair dismissal claims where somebody's been dismissed on the basis of their capability for the role. Naturally, a tribunal is going to be pretty forensic in its approach, and it's going to want to know the background. It's going to want to know, well, you know, what's been raised, by whom and when, and what's been discussed with an individual. And if you've got that absence of information and paperwork to support the whole decision-making process, you're really going to be scrabbling around to evidence why it's all fair.
I'm just going to add into that as well, is if you're, you know, if you're moving one person from one team into another, it's worthwhile encouraging the new manager to go back and look at the previous appraisal as well so that they can see if there are any issues. Because, again, one of the biggest things that lands on our desk is somebody moves to under a different manager who may well have a different approach, different expectations. And it's the management of that transition that can sometimes be quite difficult. So using that appraisal is a record of what the employee has seen about the view of their performance. So if the manager comes on board and says, this person's rubbish, or they're not working quickly enough, or they're not achieving, they can look back at the appraisal, see or meets expectations or whatever it is, or some commentary. And that should flag, in my view, right, well, hold on a second, let's just think about how this is going to be managed. And that's where HR can come in and help guide them and put in place something which isn't then just going to hit the employee like a train and cause the issues that land on our desk. So yeah, review of appraisals on transition from one manager to another is something else that I would add in there.
Okay. Before your next tip, should we just quickly look at this question we've had? So what are your thoughts on companies that take the view of individuals taking ownership of their training, upskilling, and obtaining regular feedback outside of formal appraisals, let's say twice yearly? I mean, I think in terms of individuals taking ownership of their training and upskilling, then yeah, fantastic. I mean, why wouldn't you encourage that? I think where you recognize there's a skill shortage, and I think it's incumbent on you as the employer to, first of all, identify it. Secondly, try and do something about it. You know, sure, I'm not talking about somebody coming to you on the basis that they've got a particular qualification. It turns out they haven't. But on the basis that you've identified that with some extra help or support, somebody could be a more productive employee or more engaged, or, you know, have a broader skills base, something that's going to help with their output.
Career progression as well. Yeah.
Career progression, yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, it's probably going to be a mix of things. Like, there's going to be a minimum base layer of training that you need to provide to keep them relevant in terms of their skills. Mm. And then separate to that, I think it's probably all about personal development, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think this the question about obtaining regular feedback outside of formal appraisals. I mean, my view is that feedback should happen regularly anyway. But that's where the meetings with the managers and the kind of a relationship with the manager is so important, because an employee should be able to say to their manager, How do you think I'm doing? Or, is there any feedback you can give me on that particular topic? Now, that's a really scary question for an employee to ask most of the time, unless the manager is of the mindset of, I've got your back, I'm here to support you, my door's open. If you ask me questions like that, then, I am going to be constructive in my feedback and I will provide you with support. If you're creating that kind of environment in your business, then fantastic. But it's not something that's going to happen across the board. So by all means have that, but they're also you need to also recognize that a lot of employees are not going to feel confident about having those conversations, in which case you are going to have some kind of framework in place to catch them so that you're driving it rather than just putting the onus on them entirely.
Yeah, I
That
agree
would
with
be my view on that.
you. Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah.
Thanks for the question.
Really good question. Really good, good food for thought, I think.
Policies.
Yeah, my tip five. Tip five, follow your policies, right? So here's what happens. Comes to us. Oh, we run a grievance process. This is what we've done. This is all the rest of it. And we go, right, can we see your grievance policy? And it's not been used. People haven't really looked at it properly, or performance management might be one. We find a lot of clients spend the money to have policies in place and then forget to refer to them. And they are there for a reason. Now, I know that for most of you, I will be, I'm pushing a door open here that you will probably be banging on about yourselves, having worked hard probably to put those policies in place and to encourage the business to use them. But we're just reinforcing what you already think. It's a really easy point to lose on cross-examination at the tribunal. Have you read the policy? Or why didn't you follow it? It's those types of things. Also, the policies give your managers really good guidance on how to deal with these things. So performance management, there's normally quite a few paragraphs at the start. Most management issues will be dealt with informally by way of speaking with you to see if things can be re resolved informally. That's what it says. Now, if the manager hasn't done that, they need to be told, this is what the policy says. You need to go away and do that, and until you've done that, we can't go to that formal stage. Sometimes you will have good reasons to depart from them, but if so, try and record why you've departed from them somewhere. That could be the personnel that are involved in dealing with the processes or whatever it is. But they're a good guide. They're like your manual as to how things should be run.
And I think it's almost better actually to not have a policy than have a policy which is just never ever used or referred to. Because you'll get tripped up on that when it comes to the tribunal stage. You will be cross-examined on it and asked about it. Whereas if you don't have a policy in the first place, I'm not talking about things like investigating grievances, but some other policies that are out there, you're better off not having them than having them and not using them, I think.
Okay, and following on from that's tip six. In terms of your policies, which one are you using? Right, so identify early on whether you're going down the route of performance or conduct. Sometimes these can overlap, but the process to be followed is very different. So, for example, we might get asked the question, this person's just really disruptive at work. They're meant to work collaboratively, they don't. Is that a performance issue or is it a conduct issue? You need to kind of make a decision which one you're going down at the start, because performance process can lead to a PIP, which is, here's your improvement for a month, then another warning, here's your improvement for a month. Conduct obviously is very different because that's a behavioural issue. It's not easy, but it's definitely something to think about at the very start, because you don't want to be changing horses 6 months down the line when you're quite keen to bring things to a head and move somebody out of the business.
Yeah, tribunals definitely hate that, we know. Tip seven, then, when it comes to formal processes that you're following, just make sure that you've got the right people in place to deal with those processes. So what I'm talking about is, for example, in the context of a potential conduct dismissal, the investigation stage is going to be critical. And this is a big risk area in terms of future liability. So again, we see things from the employment tribunal perspective, and we know that employment judges will be forensic at picking over every single step in the process that you've taken over. It might be 2 years ago, given what we were talking about in terms of tribunal delays at the start. So tribunals, if you haven't been to one, they take a very, very forensic approach. They'll look at individual emails, they'll look at policies, they'll look at the steps that have been taken. An investigation stage is going to be critical. So therefore, who are you giving the role of investigator to? Are you going to train that person in terms of how to be an effective investigator? Do they understand how what they are doing fits in with the fairness of a future dismissal. So do they understand how critical their role is and what the implications of, in inverted commas, getting it wrong can be? Do they understand their role generally? So, you know, they're quite fundamental points to address. Now, if you're a larger organization, some of our clients that have, you know, maybe 5,000, 10,000 employees, they will have dedicated people who they will be their go-to people for investigations. And those people have been upskilled. They understand, you know, as much as they need to, the legal framework that they're working within, they understand the policies and they know what they're doing in terms of running a fair investigation process. If you're a smaller organization, you know, maybe you don't have investigations that often, but you've got one coming up, it is an opportunity. There's guidance out there. There's free ACAS guidance on the role of an investigator. It's always worth giving people the support they need so they can discharge that responsibility carefully. We run training sessions on it. We've done quite a few sessions on it this year for teams. We do the training for HR teams. We do the training for managers as well. So there are resources available to upskill, but the investigation stage is always going to be a critical part of any decision-making process when it comes to an ultimate dismissal. And it is something that is going to be forensically looked at if you're facing a claim.
And just to add into that, to give an example of our experience, you know, very often we'll look at an investigation report when we get given like the pack, if you like, and we'll go, why didn't they speak to that person? Or this email's referred to, can we see a copy of that email? And the investigators never picked up on it. So it's difficult then to kind of go back and plug those gaps if we're looking at it after the event. So it's just, it's the detail. The devil really is in the detail there. Right. Okie dokie. So tip 8, and this is where we do kind of go into different processes, having said that we wouldn't. But as a reminder, 5 fair reasons to dismiss are capability or qualifications, conduct, redundancy, statutory restrictions, i.e. don't have the right to work in the UK, some other substantial reason, which is the catch-all bracket for everything that doesn't fit into any of the previous ones. How do you know which one to rely on? Well, this is where the investigation stage is important. So in a conduct case, make sure your investigator is different from the disciplining manager, the person who's ultimately going to make the decision. The investigator is there only to be the fact finder, to gather those facts, and should not be making a decision on potential sanctions. They can suggest that the matter should proceed to disciplinary, that's fine, but no mention should be made of the sanction, as that is for the disciplinary manager to decide.
We've seen a couple of cases where HR have been deemed to kind of overstep their authority on that as well, in terms of getting involved in the actual decision-making process.
Yeah, absolutely. Make sure, I've kind of already covered it in the point before, make sure the investigation is thorough and that everything is properly looked at. I mean, we say, you know, the law says there needs to be a thorough investigation, you know, and there needs to be a reasonable decision, but it's the thoroughness of that investigation which will come under the spotlight of the tribunal. Make sure the employee has everything ahead of the meeting so that they can prepare for it. This is one of the fundamental parts of the fairness of any process. If you're recognising a union, always check your union agreement to see when they need to be informed. At what stage are they included? Is it just when the union union rep comes along to support the employee in the meeting? Performance, so different reason. We love notes of informal discussions. You know, it's not that you have to follow up by email after every one-to-one, but managers scribbled notes, anything like that, little file notes that they've kept for themselves. All of that is gold for us when we're talking about evidence of performance discussions. That's really useful. And a formal process should be the next logical step to informal discussions. So if informal discussions haven't happened, you've got to go back and go, really sorry, but you've got to have those first. When it comes to the formal process, you will need a decent PIP, performance improvement plan, and it's got to be achievable within the timeframes. Things like sales, where it's measurable, so much easier to do. These are the targets. This is what we want to achieve. And even more so where you can say this is comparative to your colleagues who are all doing this already. That's brilliant. It is not always easy in roles where it's not so clear what the targets are. So that's back to your job description. That's back to them what the managers told the employees are their expectations. If it's failing to achieve stuff by deadlines, make sure that's part of your PIP. So they've got to be based on smart objectives and nothing woolly. I would suggest that if you're using these processes properly, managers should think that about changing their mindset. See this as an assistant tool to help an employee succeed rather than the start of a dismissal process, which is, you know, even if in reality that's what it is. Because if the mindset is that it's a tool to success, then that PIP plan is going to set out very clearly what is actually required and support given to the employee to achieve it.
And we did, in fact, we did a deeper dive, if I can use that term, into managing underperforming employees, I think back in May, maybe. But we've got a session on that, which just walks you through all the sort of things you've got to think about in terms of a PIP process to get to that point of being able to fairly dismiss. Tip nine then, and it's really relevant to dismissals, be alive to discrimination. And one of the reasons why it's relevant, aside from the principle of obviously not wanting to discriminate against anybody, is at the moment, while we've got this 2-year qualification period for unfair dismissal claims, sometimes we see employees who don't have that 2-year qualification period look for another angle to try and still run a claim against you. And that could be, well, I think my dismissal was discriminatory in some way. Now, claims can lurk in corners where you might not expect to see them. We see lots of discrimination claims where the main claim isn't a viable discrimination claim, but in the handling of the process itself, and sorry to go back to process, but in terms of the way the process has been handled or an investigation has been handled, there are pockets of potential discrimination. So an example of that could be extending one person's probationary period where you don't extend another person's in similar circumstances. That's different treatment. Treatment is probably less favorable treatment. What's the reason for that less favorable treatment? Is it because of protected characteristic? Another example might be dismissing one person for an act of misconduct where you've not dismissed somebody else in similar circumstances. Again, you've got on the face of it, difference in treatment there. And what is the reason for that difference in treatment? And that's what a tribunal is going to want to examine. Ideally, you'll have the standards set across the business to ensure that fairness of treatment, but it's always worth asking yourself, how did we handle this situation in the past? Now, if you've never handled that situation, come and talk to us, because chances are we've handled that situation for another client. So, you know, we've got a lot of experience to draw on there. But think about, you know, standards you've set previously, approaches you've taken previously. You may have very good grounds to depart from a previous approach. I mean, just because you've done something a particular way in the past doesn't mean you always have to do it that way, of course. But you need to be clear in your own mind about why you're maybe diverting your approach. And you may have very, very valid reasons for that. When there is a decision, just a difference, sorry, just ensure you've got that good business reason for changing your actions. And of course, the tips that we've mentioned already on this call today, they'll really help you follow a correct process, help you to run a fair investigation, make sure your manager is skilled on that as well. So, you know, for hopefully following these tips are really going to close the door and limit your exposure to discrimination claims.
Can I just give a couple of other examples on the lurking discrimination? Because what we find is, you know, somebody says you go to a preliminary hearing at a tribunal, and the tribunal says, what part of the process is discrimination? And the employee goes away and thinks about it and picks through and comes up with all these little things like, I didn't get the notes of the meeting within, you know, 7 days, which is what it says in the policy, whereas other people did. And they only did that because I've raised this grievance about discrimination. So there's a victimization claim. You know, it might be you didn't allow me to postpone my hearing for longer than 5 days, whereas you did it for other people. That's discrimination. It's little bits like that, which you might think just sound absolutely pathetic, but if you can't explain why it didn't happen, there's a prima facie case for discrimination, and it lands you in as much trouble as if the main decision was discriminatory. So it's those types of things that we habitually see, you know, normally a whole list of them. Right, sorry. Tip 10, final tip. And frankly, if all of the above sounds like it's a hell of a headache, yes, it is. And sometimes you'll need to take what us employment lawyers call a commercial risk. It could be cutting short a process, but it's about making these decisions with your eyes open. And that's where your friendly employment lawyers can really add some value. So do a cost-benefit analysis around dismissal. Most of you will want to follow HR processes. You know, a lot of effort's put into your training, your experience, the policies that you've got in place, and the fact that, you know, you feel that it's morally right to follow these processes. The business will want to move on quickly most of the time. So is it worth the investment to run a process, or is it quicker to cut to the chase and have a protected conversation? And frankly, much will depend on the pot available to pay employees off, and much will depend on your approach to risk. You have to kind of park, if you're going down this route, you have to park the moral view of it's not fair that, you know, underperforming or badly behaved employees get paid out, right? And we totally get that. But these processes can often grow legs and take you in directions you don't expect. Employees and employers become horribly polarized. You know, offense is taken by who says what to whom during the investigation, which can spawn further grievances, damage a relationship. And very often it's an assessment of, is it really worth the pain, the cost, or is it better for the running of the business, the smooth running of the business, the commercial success of the business, from which other employees will benefit, just to cut to the chase? So remember, if you're following a performance process, it's likely to take at least 3 months. And that's a, you know, that's the sort of like the shortest period that we can usually come across, setting aside whether an employee appeals at each stage. You know, at the end of that, notice is still going to be payable, and there's still a risk of a claim being raised. And as we said at the start, you can't prevent employees from bringing claims. Might be best to get certainty under a settlement agreement, give them the 3 months' money instead, or at least give them the option. And, you know, and that way everybody can move on. And frankly, that's the way that most of our clients probably do handle a lot of this stuff. So the cost benefit analysis is important.
Definitely. It's all about being commercial. And sometimes you want to cut those corners. And for us, you know, where we can help you is just you understand exactly what you're in for. If you do want to depart from black letter law, you know, absolute ACAS type compliance, and we can have those discussions. There are 10 tips just before we wrap up, just a couple of questions. So should policies explain each stage, or should they be an overview? Well, the good news is you're in control. It's entirely up to you. You can frame it however you want. You could cross-refer back to a government website or an ACAS guide, for example, in terms of how you'll handle a particular thing, or you could have a super, super detailed, particularized policy as well. So you're in control of that, and you can set the rules really. But I think the takeaway point in terms of policies and how this ties in with dismissals is, if you've got a policy, then make sure people know about it and follow it and use it. Otherwise, when you're in tribunal, you're going to get cross-examined as to why you've not, and you might not have an answer. So thank you for that question. Someone's also asked, can you repeat the name of the webinar you did in May on the performance processes? I think it's called, it's something like our top tips for managing underperforming employees. But again, you can find it on our website, npmlegal.co.uk. I'm pretty sure, I'm certain the recording of it is on Spotify, and it's also on Amazon Music as well. So you'll be able to find that performance podcast that we recorded. So thanks for those. Thanks very much for joining, everybody. We're going to have just another short little break before we get back into the two-week cycle. So we'll be back on 11 o'clock on Thursday, the 12th of September. We're going to be looking at employment contracts, how you can cut the legalese from employment contracts, how you can better reflect your organization's approach and values, and what things you need to include to protect your business interests as well. So join us for that session. In the meantime, all of our past sessions are on Spotify. I think there are around 50 to choose from. So something for everybody on there, plenty of listening. Thanks, everybody, for joining and for your contributions today. Until next time, cheerio.